We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track four games at once with multi-view mode and catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
The Dan Bernstein Show. Weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
We've got two more hours of The Last Dance coming our way Sunday night, and we've all been enjoying it. This was even many of the critics who saw the first eight did not see these last two, so we're all going to be enjoying it together as they were fairly recently cobbled together and finished up. One voice, face that you have heard and seen has been that of Dr. Todd Boyd throughout this documentary on ESPN. Todd Boyd is the Catherine and Frank Price Endowed Chair for the Study of Race and Popular Culture. He's professor of cinema and media studies in the USC School of Cinematic Arts, and he has been an author and lecturer about pop culture and hip-hop culture as well, and it's been terrific hearing him discuss not just the size of the Michael Jordan phenomenon or the Bulls phenomenon, but how everything played in concurrent with socio-political themes as well. He's been tremendous. And this was a conversation I wanted to bring back because I hope you enjoy listening to it as much as I enjoyed having it. And I asked Dr. Boyd to start out with a little meta-criticism about the documentary itself and the way we are all consuming it and what it means to him.
It reminds me of, when I was growing up, there were three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC. And, basically there are three things on television. I mean, you'd have some local channels depending on where you live, but there's three major networks. And whatever was going down was going to happen on one of those three networks. And so even if you were watching one of the other two, and one was sort of at the center of the conversation, everybody was familiar with it. It's not the way we consume media now. I mean, social media, multiple channels available for people to watch. People have whatever they're doing in their own lives. And so to have a situation where it seems like a huge percentage of the population, or at least it feels that way, has been watching this and, commenting on it and posting photos and memes, it feels like a communal experience, of course, specific to the moment we're living through. So that part of it's, I think, excellent. On the other hand, because of the circumstances we're living through right now, at least in California, it may be different in other places, but, lockdown over the country, you can't really go out in the public and talk about what you've seen. So everybody's watching it and everybody's experiencing it, but then the sort of aftermath of it takes place on social media, but you can't really go out in the public and engage it afterwards the way you can while you're watching it.
It's seeing all of this juxtaposed with the modern NBA and what it's become and how the nature of NBA stars has changed in large part due to the interactiveness, interconnectedness of social media and understanding a little bit that their role as citizens is something more important to some of these stars. What do we now know about Jordan, perhaps with some of the new context, now that we can see this and compare it to what we are seeing in sort of the postmodern NBA? Are there any new conclusions to be drawn about all of these things that happened so long ago?
Well, I think, when you think about it in that way, Jordan was pre-social media. You know, if we stop talking about Jordan after 98 or even, you know, when he came back and played for Washington, you're still early 2000s, and that's a different story. But, you know, what we're looking at in The Last Dance, you know, all this existed before social media. I mean, the Internet was brand new. If you think about, you know, players who have come after Michael to, you know, perhaps sit in that same seat, Kobe Bryant, LeBron James, these are athletes. Kobe in the second half of his career for sure was a figure very visible in social media. And LeBron's, you know, entire career, it seems like, has grown up around, you know, the Internet, social media, things like that. So Michael is a superstar from a different era. It's hard to believe, but that was, you know, if you go to 98, 22 years ago. I think, you know, when you look at Michael and all those stories about, you know, things he did in practice and, you know, I mean, I knew all these things because, you know, this is part of what I do, but the public didn't know. And so I think now, because of social media, people just know a lot more about athletes because athletes are able to, you know, dictate their own narrative through social media. Michael's a guy who was a superstar at a time when the narrative was being filtered through, you know, mainstream media. And so it's different because now I think people have a lot more connection to their superstars. For a lot of people, what they're seeing in this documentary was unknown. And I think that's why looking back at it, it's really informing a lot of people. If we were to look at a contemporary superstar, somebody like LeBron, he's more visible in social media on a regular basis, it probably wouldn't seem as revealing because a lot of this information would already be out there.
So many things happened concurrently with Jordan's rise in sports, and perhaps the most important was the acceleration of the evolution of hip-hop culture. And I'm 50 years old. I went to college in 1987, not really having heard much hip-hop music. I just wasn't into it. I wasn't exposed to it at that time. And meeting people in college, especially my friends from New York, who said, because I had heard of Run DMC, and then I started listening to it, I'm like, all right, something's going on here. And that leads into the deep dive into the New York stuff and Eric B. and Rakim and Big Daddy Kane and then Public Enemy. And I actually would share a story that actually when Do the Right Thing came out in 89, at the theater where I was in the Chicago suburbs, when I went to see it right when it came out, two rows in front of me, I realized at the end of the movie it was Craig Hodges, who was sitting there actually watching that movie. And the explosion and the watching it all unfold in front of us. Was Jordan ever actively a part of that? Because the essence of it and some of what's significant about hip-hop culture always seemed to be something Jordan kept at arm's length even while he was selling shoes.
Well, I think if we look at Jordan in terms of the period when he came into the culture, the mid-1980s, you know, 84 draft, you know, the Air Jordan sneakers are very much a part of hip-hop culture, but that is something that would evolve and connect over time. I always like to point to the fact that, you know, when Michael went to the All-Star game in 85 wearing his Air Jordans and, you know, an entire sort of Air Jordan fit, as they say. A lot of people didn't like this. He's also, you know, he has gold chains on. And these were the things at the time that people associated with hip-hop culture, which was itself, as you point out, you know, in its really early stages, especially outside of New York. But, you know, I mean, Michael's a year older than I am. I was into hip-hop from day one, but I might have been a bit more enthusiastic than some of the other people my age. Over time, this would grow. I think when people think of, say, basketball and hip-hop culture, they think of the Fab Five, which is, you know, from the early 90s, certainly influenced by Michael. I think it's just the point that Michael came along. It was real early in that basketball-hip-hop connection, and ultimately the manifestation of that link would be Allen Iverson. And so, you know, in that famous play when Iverson, you know, crosses Jordan over much later in Jordan's career, around the time that the Last Dance is set, Iverson became the symbol and the focus of that connection. Jordan is a bit early in the process. There are some hip-hop elements, and I think it's been cool to use hip-hop music as a way of scoring this documentary. But Michael's a little early in the process, and I think just a few years' age difference would mean that by the time he gets to the, you know, near the end of the second retirement, he's a few years older than the people who are being associated with hip-hop. Shaquille O'Neal, you know, I mentioned Chris Webber and the Fab Five. So there's maybe some years difference, and Michael's at the front end of that. And then, you know, Iverson, of course, is even younger. And so going forward, you have a lot of guys coming into the NBA straight out of high school starting in 1995. So the league gets to be younger, especially fast. And by this time, I think Michael has moved on.
Jordan also was able to transcend some of the frictional aspects between established NBA culture and, as you say, as the NBA got modern and more stylized. The couple examples that come to mind would be length of shorts, when they had the length of shorts police out there and they're actually measuring them because David Stern was concerned. I had a conversation with David Stern on these airwaves, in fact, after the controversial decision to airbrush Allen Iverson's tattoos off of his body for the cover of Hoop magazine. Then there was Jerry Krause at one point talking about the cornrow hairstyle. And there was a belief that that was something that was just an image that they didn't want. And it's just more chapters that the NBA has always had in this push and pull with a discomfort with that aspect of the culture. And in large part, it's one of these things that it never really happened with Jordan in any specific way. Is it because he was great? Is it because he was somehow figured out a way to be anodyne in that regard? But he knew where to position himself, so that wasn't ever really an issue.
Well, as I'm saying, a lot of that has to do with age. You know, Jordan is the guy who's associated with the longer shorts, but it's the Fab Five in cultural memory who's associated with sort of fully adopting that style. Jordan's the first guy to wear long shorts, but when the Fab Five wore them, they were longer and even bigger. They sort of reflected this hip-hop style. You know, the cornrows, those things had been popular back in the 70s. They became popular again around Iverson in the late 90s. Again, as I'm saying, Michael was older and then having moved on. You know, all of those issues that came up with basketball and hip-hop, late 90s, early 2000s, the NBA was playing hip-hop music throughout the arenas. Hip-hop had a very prominent place, but there was controversy around hip-hop style, you know, and of course, ultimately in the mid-2000s, you get the dress code. A lot of that is Michael's era, you know, his age, the time that he came around, and how those cultural changes happened. And Michael was so far above even the league at a certain point in terms of his image. He was a global icon, and so a lot of things that may have applied to people younger than him just didn't really apply to him because he was seen as a superstar on such a massive level that he had his own lane and everybody else was dealing with those style controversies that came about because of hip-hop.
We're talking with author and professor Dr. Todd Boyd here on Sports Radio 670 The Score. Something, an image from this documentary that stands out to me, and it's something when we had Bill Cartwright on the other day, we talked to him about it, that really my jaw drops. When here's Patrick Ewing now. Patrick Ewing is talking and very honestly and openly about Jordan, you know, being snatching his soul, you know, stealing away his dreams for so many years in so many heartbreaking ways. And what is Patrick Ewing wearing? He's wearing the Jumpman logo on his shoulder. We think of the term "and," and we have abstracted the term. But when you think about being branded, Jordan put it on him right there. And you talk about owning somebody. He's branded him there. And I just, it was incredible to me to think about that. What's the significance of that logo? Even if it's not necessarily having to do directly with Jordan himself, what is the meaning of it? What may be the lasting meaning of that particular logo?
Well, I mean, think about how many people in history have had their own logo. You know, not very many. The logo, the Jumpman logo, I think just embodies everything that Michael Jordan meant to the culture. You know, it starts with the sneakers, and of course we have a whole sneaker culture now that grew up around, you know, Air Jordans, a huge sneaker culture. The Jumpman logo embodies the fact that, you know, as a basketball player, Michael was incredible. But he transcended the basketball court. He became an icon across the globe, you know, endorsing numerous products. I mean, a Jumpman is Nike and then Brand Jordan. But it just embodies the fact that, you know, he became this superstar who went beyond his sport and became recognizable just across the world. And that cultural legacy is part of his overall legacy. We're not just talking about him as a basketball player. We're talking about him as a basketball player and a cultural icon. And there's only a really, really small handful of athletes in American history who could claim both of those mantles, athlete and icon. So he's in a really, really small group, and I think that Jumpman logo just kind of embodies all that he represented culturally, as well as, of course, speaking to where it started, which was on the basketball court.
Last question for you, Dr. Boyd. One of the running themes in this has been Michael Jordan's single-minded ruthlessness. And it can be thought of in, there's no right or wrong answer. It can be a remarkable and impressive desire to win. And we've talked to people who say they want to watch with their kids to show their kids, this is what it takes. This is dedication. This is intense professionalism. And it also has been depicted as kind of a pathology. Is what's wrong with this guy? And who's like this? And is, you know, inventing some of these windmills at which to tilt, you know, is this okay? So I guess the question for you is this image of his, of this almost this human insatiable competition shark. The rings are there, the trophies are there, and the ends might have justified the means, but is it positive or negative for sports culture or for popular culture that this is who he is and was?
I would say it's American. That's what I would say. I wouldn't characterize it as positive or negative. It's American. I think what Michael represented was an especially American desire to win at all costs, to dominate. You know, you said it, the ends justify the means. It's interesting, and I think a lot of people would like to think, oh, you know, he lifted weights and he got better after the Pistons kept beating him, and he just, you know, was relentless in pursuing his goal. And, you know, maybe that is true partially, but I think what people are seeing now is, you know, Michael was not a nice guy. I think it's kind of interesting. A lot of people have been going after Isaiah Thomas, but, you know, why is it okay to berate and humiliate and abuse people in one instance and it just be considered the drive to win? And in another case, Isaiah is considered the worst person in the world because he walked off the floor and wouldn't shake Michael's hand. That's a bit hypocritical. I think what you see in both cases, Isaiah, of course, native of Chicago, Michael, you know, they wanted to win, and winning is sometimes not pretty. And maybe the public doesn't recognize that this is what it takes to win an NBA title. It becomes an almost maniacal focus. There's a lot of, you know, things that transpire that are not positive, that are not life-affirming, that are kind of dark and negative and just problematic from a human standpoint. So I think the lesson is, you know, when you talk about this pursuit, this is an American pursuit. A lot of people are very comfortable saying that, you know, the ends justify the means. If this is what you have to do to win, then so be it. I mean, Michael's a product of his environment. As we all are. And so when I look at it, I don't think of it necessarily as positive or negative. I think of it as this is the American way. And for that moment in time, Michael Jordan represented it in ways that were not always nice and neat and clean and polite, but were the opposite of all that. And so, you know, a lot of people will look at that and say, you know, I want to win, and they'll excuse, you know, certain bad behaviors in the pursuit of it. And maybe other people will look at it and say, you know, I want to win and hopefully try to be a better person about it. Is that possible? One does not know. But I think it's an interesting lesson in one's method and one's approach, and whether or not if you win at the end, it kind of erases all of the negativity that may have led up to it.
I hadn't thought of The Last Dance as a mirror being held up to all of us, but indeed that's what you described. This is fascinating stuff, Dr. Boyd, and I really appreciate you taking the time to join us today. Dr. Todd Boyd, solid, solid stuff. I hope we see more of him in the final couple of episodes. And something that's kind of been bugging me that I have been wanting to get to that we talked about on Monday, but I got to get back to this. There's something that was said in The Last Dance that's absolutely wrong. It's just plain wrong. And it's clearly been allowed to just sort of sit there without any pushback from people who know better. But it had to do with Jordan and baseball. And they left you with an impression there from some people being very courteous to him and very kind to him, but very, very wrong. And it needs to be said, because I know what people in professional baseball were saying, and it's not what you heard. So I got to set the record straight on that. I should have pushed back on it more at the time, but we didn't have time, because we're sort of dealing with everything sort of in its totality. So I just want to take a couple minutes to tell you the truth about Jordan and baseball that wasn't represented adequately so far in the documentary. I'm Dan Bernstein, middays, 9 to noon on The Score.
This is 670 The Score, Chicago's number one and most listened to sports station, period. Thanks for keeping us on top, Chicago. This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago's sports station.
The fact of the matter is, in my opinion, if Michael Jordan had stayed with baseball, he would have gotten to the major leagues. But when the baseball strike started in 94, and Major League Baseball came up with what was a really dumb idea of trying to start the season with replacement players.
Today in spring training camps across the nation, replacement baseball players facing replacement baseball players.
There was a strike that year, and they asked him to cross the picket line. Michael said, no, I'm not doing it.
Michael Jordan has said all along that he will not play in replacement games during the strike. A man of his word, Jordan today walked out of the White Sox camp.
That's from The Last Dance regarding Michael Jordan and his time as a professional baseball player. With all due respect to Jerry Reinsdorf, a couple of things are true here. First of all, as the owner of a Major League Baseball team, he could have put Michael Jordan on the White Sox if he wanted. He's the owner. He can sign anybody he wants. He can overrule his base people. It doesn't have to be by merit. And it is possible that he's not lying in that regard, because it would be under his control if he wanted to simply wave a magic wand and make Michael Jordan a Major League Baseball player. At some point, theoretically, he could have done so. Just like the Mets ownership, the Wilpons can do with Tim Tebow if they want to make him a major leaguer. And Tim Tebow's a better baseball player than Michael Jordan, by the way. I was working in professional baseball that summer, the summer before, the summer after. In 1994, I was with a really talented Rockford Royals team that ended up losing in the championship series that year to the Cedar Rapids Colonels. And when you're around any minor league team in affiliated ball, scouts are everywhere.
everywhere. They're always coming through. You're always talking to scouts. And you get the roving organizational instructors that work with every level. Occasionally, you get big league executives would come by. And I was always looking for them because I could always put them on the air with me when I was doing games solo. They were always there to hang out and be around and buy you an inning or two and give you another voice. They'd give you a little break so you can get some coffee. But the idea of Jordan playing in the minors, especially in Double A, and we understand why that he was in Double A because of for media purposes. And I know he batted 202, and they said yes, he drove in 50 runs and he worked very, very hard. And it was very nice of the hitting coach Mike Barnett to be complimentary, and very nice of Terry Francona to say those things. But there is no way in hell that on merit, and strictly on merit, that he would have been close to making the major leagues. If any scout, if you just said, no names on the jersey, forget who it is, and if the guy looks familiar, ignore it, and you just had an absolutely objective scout parachuting in, would take one look at that swing and say, nope. Not to mention, no power. He generated no power. You think Jason Hayward makes you crazy with a big, strong body and a great build, and the ball just doesn't go as far or as fast as it's supposed to go? Jordan was a slap hitter. This needs to be pushed back against. And we would watch the highlights and stuff, and it would be on in the clubhouse and around where we used to hang out, and right near Marinelli Field in Rockford. There used to be a place called the Stadium Lounge. They had a really good meatloaf there. We used to go there and drink beer and eat meatloaf and watch sports. And it would come on, and the actual baseball people, the scouts, the coaches, the former major leaguers, the guys whose job it was to develop guys, they were openly derisive. Go back and watch Jordan's head. Just watch his head. Watch his head move. Maybe you are a little league coach or a high school coach. Just look at the amount of head movement. There's a reason he couldn't hit a curveball. There's a reason for this. Just know this. And this is the absolute truth. He was not close. If you want to applaud him, there's middle ground here. You can absolutely say it's a remarkable achievement for someone who had never really played baseball before since he was a kid to hit 202 in Double A. Absolutely. But to then conflate that, don't even mention the major leagues. And I'm not trying to paint this too as from, I heard it from minor league players because they knew that he didn't deserve to be in Double A. They knew that. And those coveted Double A spots, getting from A ball, especially low A ball in the Midwest League where I work, getting to Double A was a big deal because most guys burn out in A ball. It's really hard to get out of A ball. And once you're in Double A at the right age, you're on the track. You're building toward a legitimate shot. And I'd be lying if I didn't tell you that there was a lot of cussing and a lot of unhappy young kids from America, from Venezuela, from the Dominican Republic, from Puerto Rico, our whole locker room. There were a lot of kids like, what's this guy? Look at this crap. Look at this guy. He's in Double A doing what he's doing, because they knew that they were taking a job from somebody, but not a shot. You can absolutely be amazed and the fact that he did what he did, hit 202 in Double A, awesome. Great. And he worked really, really, really hard. But to say that he was undoubtedly going to be a Major League Baseball player, no effing way. Not good enough. Not good enough. No matter how much he wanted to practice, the ball didn't leave his bat fast. We didn't have exit velocities then, but he just didn't hit it hard, let alone enough. And teams don't have places on their rosters for slap hitting corner outfielders. Those jobs don't exist. Not a Major League Baseball player. And it's okay. Mike in Allsup says, thank you for saying that. I always thought that he looked dorky. The 847
says he was a world-class athlete, but hitting a baseball at the MLB level is nearly impossible. 815 says they said if he had 1,500 at-bats with his work ethic, he would have worked his way up and gotten better. No! Come on. He's not 19. The guys who work their way up and get better are not 30 years old or whatever, 31 or 32 or whatever he was. It was fun. It was a great little story. I know it was nice for him, and it rejuvenated and recharged him. But I can tell you, without question, unequivocally, if you really, really, really watch him objectively, from the moment he arrived, for any video you have of the tryouts, not a baseball player. And I was laughing when I heard some of those guys being as nice as they were. And Terry Francona, very diplomatic, and talking about how he hit 202 and had a 13-game hitting streak. Because they were just putting it over the plate to him. Because in large part, they knew it wasn't going to go anywhere when he hit it, because he didn't have any power. So there. I felt I had to say it, and now I feel better. And now I can tell you, we have the Midday Midway coming up, and our Friday Midday Midways always get a little bit silly because they can. And there's an aspect of the COVID-19 pandemic that I didn't quite expect. We have been tracking, for better or for worse, what's been the comeback of nature and how animals have been reclaiming territory with people largely locked down and people not populating areas they once did, whether it's the herd of goats or the bears wandering around and dolphins and jellyfish and everything. There's something I didn't think about also reclaiming territory or being more likely to be seen. So we're going to get to that. And, hey, free cheeseburgers. Today, free cheeseburgers. Don't go anywhere. I've got all the information next on The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
The first half or the second half, you know, it's they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One, two.
Midway, the most important of the year.
Three, four.
The most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
9, 10.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel it.
The Midday Midway with Dan Bernstein on The Score.
So far on this Friday edition of our show, we talked baseball in the first hour. We heard from Trevor Bauer, and we heard from Scott Boras, and then we talked to Bruce Levine about everything that was going on and what Tom Ricketts told season ticket holders on their call. We replayed an interview that we did with Dr. Todd Boyd regarding The Last Dance and tried to set the record straight regarding Michael Jordan as a baseball player. White Castle has a free slider for you today, Friday, May 15th. No purchase is necessary. There is a digital coupon that you can get on their website. The fast food chain is doing this as part of a series of events for National Slider Day. This is during National Hamburger Month every May. They've got a virtual dance party hosted by the DJ duo Dude Skywalker. I don't know anything about Dude Skywalker, but they usually give away sliders, but they're creating a virtual dance party that they're going to celebrate. They're going to thank their team members who are working hard serving customers. And it's going to be on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Twitch. The party is going to raise money for the National Restaurant Association's Restaurant Employee Relief Fund. And there's a donation link available on these streaming platforms. But that's not why you called. The reason you called is you go to their website, and you get a coupon, print out the coupon, and today you can get a free slider, which means what? One-tenth of your meal, perhaps. I guess, you know, I say 10. I think my record back in the day when I could eat a whole lot more than I could now was, I think, 12 regular cheeseburgers was my record. But now I'm kind of all over the map, and I do it in waves. It's like, If I go there, when we used to go to restaurants, it was like ordering sushi. where you just sort of do it in waves and you do what you're in the mood for first, and then you say, okay, well, now I want one more of this, or I want some of this, and you just, at least with sushi, you keep doing it, and then they give you a bill and it's $700. Not so at White Castle, but it's kind of the same way. It's the where I'll just say, oh, maybe I'll have a jalapeno one, or maybe I want a cheeseburger, or maybe this one I want pickle, and I'll just get a couple and then sort of work around. But underrated, their fries are great. They're really, really, really good. And they, and the fact that they come in a bag like they do, like that, like a sack of fries and the crinkles on there, I'm a big fan. And I always, for some reason, my brain doesn't retain how much I like White Castle fries. So every time I'm surprised again, like, oh yeah, these are better than I thought.
Crinkle cut fries in general, Dan, are really reliable. We've discussed this on the I'm Fat podcast. The ceiling on the crinkle cut is not super high, but the floor is, it's you're guaranteed a really good fry with a crinkle cut. And White Castle fries are great. And I'm going there today for lunch because of you. Thank you, Dan.
Did you print out your coupon?
I'm going to in a moment. You need to know this. My 9-year-old daughter, her favorite place on earth is White Castle.
Really?
It is her absolute favorite. She has to go all the time. I usually go there maybe once a quarter just because I don't want to do that to myself too often. But her and I have the same order. It's very impressive. She's a machine at White Castle. I can only do 5. I don't know what the deal is with me and White Castle where I can't eat a ton of them. But she matches me burger for burger. It's quite remarkable.
Bacon or no bacon?
The standard slider, just a cheese slider. I think it's kind of perfect. Like the ratios are right and everything. And I also like the chicken rings. I just don't know what part of a chicken comes in a ring shape, so it kind of confuses me. Well, I can think of one, and probably not the part I want to eat.
Right, and you're not talking about like cross sections of the esophagus, right?
No, I'm not.
Okay. And we've seen articles with this kind of lead before, but this went in a little different direction. Humans are retreating and nature is taking back control. This is from Vice Canada. That's how the narrative surrounding mankind's exit from wild spaces during the pandemic goes. We've heard stories of elephants busting into a Wuhan village, drinking themselves stupid on corn wine, goats taking over small Welsh towns. Nature is healing, the memes tell us. Now, while some, if not most, of this twisted to go viral, there remains a truth to it. The majority of humans are staying inside, returning to the outside domain, or returning the domain to the animals. But what of the rarest beast, the ones who have always socially distanced from humans? I am, of course, speaking of Bigfoot, the majestic Sasquatch. What are the elusive bipedal creatures doing? Are they streaming back into typically busy parks with the glee of a horse let out to pasture? For the people who investigate them, the hunt goes on, but it's not business as usual. The researchers are forced to search alone or not at all. The industry built around Sasquatches is struggling to find its footing during the pandemic. I love how deadpan this is and how seriously they take this journalistically, because they make this kind of seem legit, and it's all part of the bit. They talked to Todd Standing, a BC, British Columbia, Sasquatch researcher who took the government to court 2 years ago for not recognizing Bigfoot's existence. Parenthetically, they add, he lost. They see the change, Standing said. I'm seeing animals moving slowly out and kind of taking the territory back. It's like nature's fighting back from the human virus. And he thinks that Sasquatches, while normally extremely timid, will inch back into it and be extremely cautious. I suspect, he says, even right now, they are going to push into new territory, into the fringes of their territory. So it's an awe-inspiring sight to imagine. One striding out of some turf in northern Oregon, reclaiming the square of land in a small victory for the whole of Bigfoot kind. And they show this guy, he's wearing a winter camouflage-type ghillie suit as he's walking through a river. And there isn't a consensus among Sasquatch researchers on the effects lockdowns are having on them. An Oregon-based researcher, Cliff Barackman, thinks that Sasquatches probably haven't even noticed there's a pandemic going on. He says, in all seriousness, they probably don't give a damn. They hardly notice humans, and they're mostly out at night. He says if there is any impact to the Sasquatch population, it's merely that they're not able to get some easy food from trash left behind by campers, but even that is a stretch. So they take this all very seriously, and this goes on and on and on. But they mention that they're masters at social distancing to begin with. It's part of the problem of being a Bigfoot researcher. It's hard to get close to these things, so they've already got that part down. Who's paying the Bigfoot researchers? Are they... I don't know how somebody can be... It would have to be something you do sort of on your own time as a side hustle thing, because I don't really see that as much of an industry if you're actually a full-time professional Bigfoot researcher. I would doubt that's a growth industry.
You know, Tom DeLonge, the musician, I believe he was from Blink 182. Is that correct? I don't know. He's now a UFO researcher. I'm right. It is Blink 182. And he has a staff of people that he does pay to track UFOs. So maybe we can get Tom DeLonge on board and see if he'll get into the Bigfoot market as well.
But he's spending Blink 182 money on this. So this isn't something like private investment, right?
Yeah, I think it's his own money, as far as I know. I mean, maybe he takes some donations or whatever from people who know the truth that aliens are real and they're among us all the time. But I don't know. But he definitely has a staff of people that he pays. So we got to get him on the Bigfoot racket. Because now the government's like, yep, they're real. And he's like, see? I told you. Like, what do you do from there when you're a UFO conspiracy guy? It's like, okay, yes, they're real. Well, okay then. I guess I'll find something else to talk about.
My work here is done.
Right.
I think Bigfoot is blurry. That's the problem.
I saw this story on NPR's website. I have not seen this person, though. Has anybody been witness to the Dreadhead Cowboy on the streets of Chicago? First, I'm hearing about a new character. We chronicle some of these Chicago characters, whether it was our naming of emaciated street Yanni many, many years ago, or our friend Joakim Noholm, and people take pictures of them and... Then there was Homeless, who used to sit on the bridge. I miss my guys. I miss these people I see around. But apparently the Dreadhead Cowboy is a real thing. His actual name is Adam Hollingsworth, and he rides a horse around Chicago. He's become apparently a little bit of a local celebrity, and people take his picture. He started doing this last summer, but he's riding more often because people are home. He says he likes the attention, and it makes people smile. He's a 33-year-old father of four who says he has more time to ride because he lost his job as an exotic dancer. So now that he's not exotic dancing, he's got cowboy boots, a black cowboy hat, looks like a vest of some kind, and he rides around on his horse. He says he fell in love with horses 4 years ago, and he wanted to get a horse, and his uncle helped him do it. And he now has four horses and a pony, and he rides his horse around the city. Have any corroboration on the Dreadhead Cowboy?
I have not seen this guy, but I want to try to get him on the show. With The Last Dance ending, we are going to need some angles.
Ooh,
so I'm going to try
boy.
To find Adam Hollingsworth. see if he's willing to ride on the show. Maybe he could do it like from on top of a horse. That would be really fun. I've never seen him.
There was a guy who used to dance in the middle of the street underneath the old Riverview flyover at the corner of Belmont, Clybourne, and Western. And he had a sign that was like, dancing for peace. And he wasn't asking for money. He was just holding a sign and smiling and dancing. And I don't know what he was doing or why he was doing it, but it certainly did not work. But I'm gonna have my eyes peeled now. I'm gonna see if I can find the Dreadhead Cowboy. I can put that on the list of there's the guy on the really tall bicycle.
I've seen him.
Dangerously tall bicycle, and I just want to see the mount and the dismount, because I don't know how he does it. I really don't. I don't know how you get on that thing. I don't know how you get off that thing, and I don't know why you want to be on that thing, because I know I would want to be off that thing.
If
anybody knows Adam Hollingsworth, the Dreadhead Cowboy, slide into our DMs, Bernstein670 on Twitter, and we'll put him on.
I've got one more Chicago street person to see if you guys know who this is. This is a guy that hangs out in Wicker Park mostly, and he has a bike with like this circle around the bike with lights on it, and people always gather around his bike because they, you know, it looks cool. Have you guys seen this guy?
No. I don't think I've seen that guy. A circle of lights around his bike.
Yes.
Circle of lights.
No. Have you seen the pig car guy?
No, but
well,
I
that's
have
just
seen.
Me.
I have seen. Wait, I don't know if you guys have seen the Danny DeVito minivan. Have you seen this? It's in Logan Square in
no.
my neighborhood. Every now and then, you see the Danny DeVito minivan riding around, and it's a little Danny DeVito like life-size sticker on the side of a minivan. It is the best thing ever.
No, there's a pig car. It's like a pink. I think it's a. Is it a Volkswagen? There's a guy that drives around in a car that's designed to look like a pig.
I don't know that one.
Haven't seen that one.
Yeah, I gotta find him. But I've seen Street Yanni a lot recently, though. Well, not recently, but when I was working, when I was in the building, I saw him like 3 or 4 times in the course of 2 weeks. He looks good.
He does. He's let the hair go white. So that's sort of changed the overall look. You know, he's showing his age a little bit. Ever since he got beat up and sort of became famous, everybody started recognizing him, and we're just happy that he was able to get back to his peripatetic ways and be healthy enough after some guy threw him off a bridge. But
yeah, you could see in his eyes that they don't look. I know he took a lot of damage to his face during. It's sad. Mm-hmm. We're not joking about it, but you can tell there's still some residual effects from that. But he seems to be getting around fine. He's got like new shoes on all the time. I think he's doing pretty well, all things considered. So that's good.
So the 630 says, what about the guy who rollerblades down Milwaukee singing at the top of his lungs? That guy I've never seen. But I will say, the trend of the, instead of wearing your headphones or earbuds or and having that little canister speaker on your bike playing music loud outwardly, or in your backpack, is an odd thing, and when it's music you don't like, it's really annoying.
There was
one guy years ago who had that in his shopping cart at the Jewel, blaring gospel, and he's singing at it's in his shopping cart, and he's singing at the top of his lungs about how much Jesus loves him.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
So how about the guy downtown on State Street that is
hell.
Telling people not to smoke cigarettes.
Yep.
And he has his own little PA, but it's very old and it doesn't work very well. But you kind of hear something in the background and you realize, hey, it's the guy telling you not to smoke.
Everybody's going to hell. You're
That's
fat. You're going to hell.
That's right.
You're gay. You're going to hell. You're smoking. You're going to hell. But he says it like real quiet into the microphone. Like no one's going to notice.
But
you have a microphone.
But his biggest issue is smoking, it seems like.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the biggest one. That's the biggest violation. But literally anything that you have as a person, if you're fat, skinny, tall, short, in his eyes, you're going to hell.
I like this bit better if I picture that guy as Herb.
Well,
your name is you're going to hell. That man's going to hell. That man's named Hellbound.
You know who we're talking about, though, right? The
I
guy
don't
in
think
State
so.
Street. Oh, he's been around forever. Like, and he hasn't aged since I've been a kid. He's just the same, usually standing outside the Old Navy on State Street.
That's it. Or yep. the Macy's.
Yeah. We'll find him. We'll get him on, too.
That's
we'll
where all the sinners go, the Macy's.
Why do you go to hell if you're fat? Is it the sin of gluttony?
I guess. I don't know. I think everyone's going to hell.
Oh, okay.
There's not really a point to his preaching either. He's just telling you, like, it's not like, and then listen to me and I'll tell you how to not go to hell. He's just like, no, as a matter of fact, you're going to hell. Continue your walk. Thank you.
Go on about your day. That is the Midday Midway. We do it most days.
around 10:40. We are broadcasting live from the Hyundai Score Studios, brought to you by your local Hyundai dealers. When we come back, we're going to get you as ready as we can for the final two episodes of The Last Dance on ESPN. On Monday, the director of the series, Jason Hayer, joined us when Will Perdue was sitting in, and it was some fascinating stuff about all that we're seeing unfold in front of us. After that, we're going to talk to Mark Lazarus of The Athletic, wrote a really cool piece with some Blackhawks history that I found absolutely fascinating. So I've got some conversations coming your way on The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.